Welcome to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine's Fiction Podcast. I'm Janet Hutchings, EQMM's editor. This month we've delved into EQMM's Passport to Crime Department, our series of translations of crime fiction from around the world, and recorded a story by French author Paul Halter entitled The Wolf of Fenrir. Paul Halter's work for EQMM has all been translated by John Pugmire, the founder and publisher of Locked Room International, a small press dedicated to the traditional mystery, especially of the locked room variety. The Wolf of Fenrir is a marvelous example of the locked room mystery at short story length. It's read for this podcast by EQMM's associate editor Jackie Sherbo. Before Jackie begins, we have a few words from John Pugmire about the work of Paul Halter.
Hello, I'm John Pugmire. I have the privilege and pleasure of being the translator of Monsieur Halter's works and publisher of 13 of his novels to date, the latest of which is The Madman's Room, one of his very best. Despite being a best-selling novelist in France and Japan, Paul says it always gives him a special pleasure when one of his stories is published in EQMM. There have been 10 so far. The Wolf of Fenrir is set in the Ardennes region of northeastern France, close to Champagne country and to Paul's native Alsace. Paul has two serious detectives, the criminologist Dr. Alan Twist and the dilettante Owen Burns, who's featured here, and who believes impossible murder to be an art form. Burns is modelled on Oscar Wilde. Dr. Twist is featured in Jacob's Ladder, which first appeared in EQMM in February 2014, and is the first story in the recently released anthology, The Realm of the Impossible.
The Wolf of Fenrir by Paul Halter, translated by John Pugmire. In that cold evening in the winter of 1912, London was shivering under a heavy snowfall. Installed by the fire in the company of my friend Owen Burns, I was enjoying the cozy comfort of his flat in St. James's Square while rereading my notes on his most celebrated cases. While his attention was concentrated on the elegant alabaster statuettes which graced the mantelpiece, I said, "Do you know what strikes one the most about your cases, old friend?" A mischievous gleam appeared in his half-closed eyes. "As seen through the prism of your subjective and restrictive reports, I appear to be a mere thinking machine, nourished on mathematical inferences, and as cold and icy as this weather. Which is a bit rich, you have to agree, for an art critic of my stature." "Really, Owen, you're not doing me justice. I've never minimized your artistic sensitivity. Quite the opposite, in fact. But that's beside the point. What I've always stressed is that you are well and truly the specialist of the impossible. Every case seems incredible, and each seems more baffling than the one before." "It's possible," he shrugged. "Also, the fact that I select them carefully might have something to do with it. Nevertheless, there's one which, in my humble opinion, stands out above the others." "Which one? The Lord of Misrule? Or perhaps the Chamber of Horace?" "No, you don't know anything about this particular hocus-pocus because you were lazing on the Riviera at the time, in the company of a young person whom you were convinced was the love of your life. When you realized on your return that it was not to be, you were so crestfallen that I didn't care to add further to your discomfort by relating this sinister story. What I can say is that it wasn't just a simple case of a phantom murderer, such as we are used to handling." "Simple phantom murderer," I exclaimed. "You intrigue me, my friend. Is there a more formidable adversary than that?" "Yes, assuredly." The crackling of the logs in the hearth was the only noise to be heard as I reflected on his words. I sighed. "I'm afraid I don't follow you." "You see, Achilles, a ghost, no matter how vindictive, is basically only a manifestation of human origin. Now, the adversary in this case had nothing human about it. In fact,
has been the greatest predator of the human race since the dawn of our Helleno-Christian civilization. Permit me to give you a hint. It has black, pointed ears and long, white teeth. A wolf? Yes, a wolf. But no ordinary wolf. I see. A werewolf. Turning towards me, Owen rolled his eyes in exasperation. No. Worse than that, I'm talking about the most terrifying wolf in the world, the one which haunted the frozen land of Niflheim and terrorized even the indomitable Viking warriors, the wolf of Fenrir. While I, disconcerted, saw visions of the monster of Nordic mythology flash before my eyes, Owen calmly lit a cigarette and went over to the window to contemplate the view of the city. He continued in a soothing voice. If you fancy it, I can describe the apparently inexplicable problem the way it was presented to me one frigid winter night, rather like this one, in fact. But come over here and look at our beautiful capital transformed into an ice palace like that of the Snow Queen. That'll put you in the mood. At the time, I also was on French soil, but not at the same latitude as you, I must point out. I was planning to pay a visit to a friend of mine who lived in the Ardennes, a region near the Belgian border, famous for its rude winters. But on that particular evening, the roads were blocked by snow, and I was obliged to stay at a hotel in a small town, where I was amazed to discover an old acquaintance nonchalantly ensconced at the bar. Perhaps you've heard me talk about Marcellus Blanchard before? No? He's a rich eccentric, well-known in racing circles, who owns a remarkable string of thoroughbreds, which he regularly enters at Longchamp and Epsom, which is where I first met him. It was a great pleasure to see that bon vivant again, debonair, the right side of 50, with carefully groomed graying hair and a perpetual gleam of amusement in his eye, as if he were unaffected by the travails of everyday life. It's a sign from above, my dear Owen. Your friend can well wait 2 or 3 days. You'll be my guest for the weekend, in my own personal hunting lodge, not far from here. It's a little off the beaten track, but it doesn't lack for creature comforts. That's extremely kind of you, Marcellus, but I've just had a rather tiring journey, and that's quite all right. You'll have the whole night to recover, but tomorrow, before tea time, as you call it, I want to see you chez moi. I've also invited a few friends, who will be delighted to meet the greatest detective of His Majesty. He grinned mischievously. No, I have a better idea. You shall be our surprise guest. I'll challenge my other guests to guess your profession. That'll spice up the evening. And you know I like nothing better than to surprise people. Yes, I'm aware you have that reputation. Didn't you once say that a friend who ceased to surprise you was no longer a friend? You leave me no way out. His grin widened. No, since you put it that way, and since I know you can resist everything but temptation, I may add that there'll be a few fillies there as well. Nodding my head in agreement, I capitulated. Coming from an expert like you, I have no doubt they'll have been well broken in. So, can I count on you? Naturally, if there are pretty girls around, I'm your man. The next day, in the late afternoon, the innkeeper drove me there in his cabriolet. After a bone-shaking quarter of an hour on a partly obliterated track, it had snowed heavily all morning. I spotted the reddish shape of the lodge on my left. My friend had not exaggerated about the isolation. There was not a living soul in sight. His country retreat stood in the heart of the countryside, on the edge of a forest of firs, dark sentinels standing out against the immaculate white of the snow. The residence was surrounded by an impressive yew hedge, broken by a dome-shaped gap leading to the front entrance. The lodge itself was of half-timbered brick construction, its windows heavily embellished with ornamental carvings, in a Baroque style totally in keeping with its owner's image. It faced a vast clearing, in the middle of which, at some 100 yards from the house, stood a cabin, which the heavy silence of the surrounding snow made appear even more isolated than it actually was. A few white flakes twirled in the glacial air, contrasting with the gray of the sky. After tipping the innkeeper handsomely, I picked up my bags, entered the yew dome, walked under a pergola colonized by a bare wisteria, and finally pressed the doorbell. Its sinister tone should have alerted me to the forthcoming danger, but at the time, I was more preoccupied with thoughts of meeting my host's ravishing guests than paying attention to omens. He had not exaggerated. I was soon comfortably ensconced in a rustic-style armchair, with a glass of Suze in hand, admiring the three members of the weaker sex amongst the guests my host had just introduced. The least striking, if I may so describe her, for she was by no means unattractive, was a diminutive woman with flaming red hair and the inquisitive eyes of a squirrel, who answered to the name of Helene. She was the mother of two, who would have thought so, with such a slender waist, and married to Philippe Udeville, a tall, well-built, carefully groomed man in the prime of life, a stuffy accountant who seemed a little out of place in the group, but whom Marcellus assured me would let his hair down after a couple of cognacs. Philippe was conversing with Louis Prams, a legendary ex-jockey, the number one in France for many years, who had often ridden Marcellus's horses to success. That profitable partnership had cemented a firm friendship between the two. I have to say, he was not physically blessed, with the body of a young boy surmounted by a large head with drooping, bushy eyebrows and a permanent look of disdain. What a contrast with his wife, Frida, a dazzling blonde who adored animals, particularly her three beagles, her three darlings whom I miss so much, which she nurtured like the children she'd never had. What would I not have given to change places with one of those lucky creatures? She must have been about 30, in other words, 10 years older than Barbara Riviere, a stunning beauty with a mane of chestnut hair who was in the company of Ian Denison, a 40-year-old salesman for an important Swedish steel company. With his blonde hair and captivating smile, he was an inveterate philanderer who had never brought the same woman twice to Marcellus's parties. I would willingly have changed places with Denison as well. Although Barbara had neither the class nor the maturity of Frida, she had the freshness and enthusiasm of youth, and an untamed expression in her emerald eyes which made her infinitely desirable, and the fact that she was planning a career as a painter was an added attraction to me. The last member of the group was Roger, Marcellus's steward, a stocky, taciturn fellow with a thick black beard who doubled as a cook, whose talents we were soon to discover. After the meal, which took place in a jovial atmosphere, I began to get a better understanding of the married guests who exchanged digs of familiarity while Barbara and I, the newcomers, tried to follow suit. Putting her husband in the dock, Helene declared, "I often feel as if I'm living with a mathematical treatise. Philippe organizes his life the way he organizes his numbers." "So you're just a number to him," teased Barbara. "Yes, in a manner of speaking." That might not seem very flattering, but in Philippe's eyes, it's a proof of love, isn't it, darling? "Of course, my dear number two." "What? Only number two?" exclaimed Helene, pretending to be offended. "Then who's number one?" "I am, darling," cooed Frida, placing a lascivious hand on the accountant's shoulder, then throwing her head back in a rippling laugh. Looking at her with a critical eye, Barbara observed, "You have an interesting face, Freya. I'd like to paint your portrait." "That's Frida, dear. But I forgive the slip of the tongue. Wasn't Freya the goddess of love and beauty?" With a supple motion which caused shimmerings of light on her tight-fitting greenish-yellow silk dress, she went over to the mantelpiece to look at her reflection in the mirror there. Striking a provocative pose, she asked me, "What do you think, Mr. Burns? You're an authority on the matter." "Which matter?" I babbled, disconcertedly. "The matter of art," she replied, with a mischievous smile. "I didn't know you personally until today. I don't often get to London, but I have a friend there who runs an art gallery. She told me about a critic who gave a glowing report on one of her exhibitions, who has exactly the same name as you." "Bravo, Frida," exclaimed Marcellus happily. "You've lifted part of the veil. But my friend Owen Burns has another talent, which has earned him fame across the channel into the bargain." I immediately became the center of attention, but I maintained an impassive, sphinx-like silence. Frida went on gaily with a defiant look in her eye. "We'll find out, Mr. Burns. You won't be able to pull the wool over our eyes the whole weekend. Men always give themselves away. And to answer your question, Barbara, I'll be happy to sit for you, as long as you don't ask me to pose nude in the snow." After an outburst of laughter and mock outrage, Frida continued, triumphant in her beauty and wit. But tell us, Barbara, how did you come to take up painting? Not many women have succeeded in that profession, and you're very young as well. Green lights flashed in the young woman's eyes. Oh, I've always excelled at portraits. What started me thinking seriously was the encouragement of a well-known painter, a friend of my father, who was moved to tears by one of my watercolors, the portrait of a particularly stupid woman. For a few seconds, the atmosphere in the lounge turned as frigid as the polar conditions outside. Marcellus hastened to change the subject. After refilling our glasses, he seized on the allusion to the goddess Freya to steer the conversation towards Nordic mythology and its close ties to that of the Greeks, hoping to spark a lively debate about who influenced whom. For there was no doubt, he explained, that Thor, the god of thunder, was the counterpart of the great Zeus. Just as the three Norns, the goddesses of fate, could be compared to the three Morai. His strategy worked, and two camps rapidly formed. Philippe Oudeville, the leader of the southern camp, argued that the gentle Mediterranean climate fostered the flowering of culture earlier than elsewhere, and, likewise, the mythology. Ian Dennison, the advocate of the opposite camp, held that the harsh northern climate produced hardy adventurers who had been the first to spread their culture abroad. His calm authority appeared to be winning the day when Frida suddenly stood up and demanded silence. Did you hear that? That howling? He is back. He senses my presence. What on earth are you talking about? I asked. For my part, I heard nothing. That's hardly surprising, whispered Marcellus in confidence, his cheeks flushed from alcohol. Our friend Frida is often the only one to hear it, and certainly the only one to go near it. It's a wolf from hereabouts, or more likely a huge wild dog. Whatever it is, we named it the Wolf of Fenrir, because it seems to be as ferocious as the legendary Nordic beast. And since our friend loves doggies... Yes, Mr. Burns, confirmed Frida with a defiant look. If I do say so myself, I'm the only one around here to have tamed him. He even comes to eat out of my hand. Really? With a name like that, you should be more careful all the same. As I recall, the ferocious monster bit off the hand of the god Tyr, even though he'd been chained up. With a giggle, she replied, Believe me, there's nothing to be afraid of. This wolf is my friend. We see each other every time I come here. To my astonishment, Marcellus explained that Frida was in the habit, on each visit, of spending one night alone in the cabin I had seen on my way over, where the Wolf of Fenrir would visit her, warm and friendly, just like a pet dog, even though his mere presence terrified everyone else in the neighborhood. I adore the contact, Mr. Burns, explained Frida, her eyes sparkling. Between Beauty and the Beast? If you like, I have an affinity with animals, which they can sense, even the most fearsome ones, and this night will be no exception. Turning to Roger, she asked, Did you prepare the cabin? Yes, madame, confirmed the steward. Everything's ready. There's dry wood in the fireplace, and I prepared a breakfast basket. After a glance at the clock, Frida went over to the window and announced, Well, I shall be off. It's still snowing, but it won't last. Ladies and gentlemen, I wish you a pleasant evening. Noticing a framed picture on one of the walls, she turned to the young painter. What do you think of the watercolor, Barbara? I presume you identified the artist straight away. It cost Marcellus a small fortune, by the way. No, not really, mumbled Barbara. It's a Turner, immediately recognizable by its luminosity. Due to the white of the paper, any self-respecting student of Beaux-Arts could have told you that. So much for setting the stage, concluded Owen. I may perhaps have been a little verbose, Achilles, but I did want you to feel the strange atmosphere which prevailed amongst that little group, isolated in the middle of the snow and the fir trees in that glacial winter night. Now I shall be more succinct regarding the discovery of the tragedy, as precisely as I can because I was not personally a witness. One final word about the conclusion of the evening. Helene retired almost immediately after Frida left, followed a few minutes later by Barbara, still fuming from the affront Frida had inflicted. We men retired at about 1 o'clock in the morning, in a state close to inebriation, not least myself, I'll be the first to admit. At about 6 in the morning, the ex-jockey Louis Prinz, who was, of course, alone in his room, all the guest rooms being on the upper floor, was awakened by a strange howling. It was followed by the sound of footsteps in the corridor. Stepping out, he found Philippe Udeville just as surprised and anxious as he was. "It must be the beast," said the accountant. "Helene heard it clearly, and she's terrified. She woke me up. All I heard was a distant murmur, which I think came from somewhere near the cabin." "Frida, alone back there. My God," stammered Prinz. "What madness to tempt fate like that? Something must have happened. What do you think?"
"The same as you, Louis. We'd better get over there as soon as possible."
5 minutes later, the two men left the lodge in the direction of the cabin as the first rays of dawn appeared behind the tops of the fir trees. They trod across a stretch of perfectly virgin snow, except for the faint footprints left by Frida during the previous evening. The moon, a thin crescent, shed its pale light on the two contrasting silhouettes. The ex-jockey, wrapped up in a fur-lined coat, led the way with quick steps, lantern in hand. He looked like a dwarf compared to his huge companion, who was wearing a voluminous black cloak. Their grim expressions indicated they were expecting the worst, and their fears were realized. As he approached the cabin, Philippe Udeville heard his companion shout out. Then he, too, saw Frida's lifeless body just in front of the open door of the cabin. She lay on her side, wearing a nightdress and woolen gown. One hand was on her breast. The other, extended in front of her, bore a terrible wound which had bled profusely onto the surrounding snow. After a brief inspection, Louis stood up, his face ashen. "There's nothing we can do for her. And there are the tracks of the infernal beast which killed her." Stunned, Udeville looked at the twin sets of tracks clearly left by a large canine disappearing into the distant forest. The beast had obviously come from there and returned the same way. But had it attacked Frida? Had it savaged her hand just as its sinister cousin had savaged Tears? For a few seconds, Udeville thought he would faint, but he quickly recovered. After assuring himself that she was indeed dead, Philippe went inside the cabin where embers were still glowing in the hearth. It consisted of a spacious single room furnished with a table, two chairs, a bench, a sideboard, and a bed in the far corner. Near the entrance stood a large grandfather clock. He opened the door and peered inside. "Are you looking for something?" asked Louis, who had just joined him. Philippe shrugged. "You never know. Go and have a look under the bed." The jockey went across the room, then crouched on all fours and squinted long and hard under the bed. He stood up and shook his head. "Nothing human or animal there." Without another word, Udeville went out with his companion on his heels, and the two of them inspected the small shed attached to the side of the cabin. There was nothing there but dry wood. "Why are you doing this? What do you hope to find?" protested Prams. "You can see the tracks leading to the forest. We're wasting time. We have to alert the others. My God, my poor Frida, it's horrible. I still can't believe it." He turned to go back to the lodge, and Philippe, who could hear him sobbing, followed him at a distance. A few minutes later, they were back in the lodge. Before going in, Prams noticed Marcellus lurking behind the window of his room. In the lounge, he found Roger, who gave him the same questioning look he gave Udeville, as the latter appeared in the doorway. The sounds of steps on the squeaky stairs announced the arrival of Marcellus, pale with anxiety, but seemingly unable to pose the question on his lips. "Let's go into the kitchen," suggested Philippe. "Roger, please prepare us something strong. We're going to need it." "Where are the others? Where's Helene?" "No, don't move. I'll go and get her." When he reappeared with his wife, Prinz, who had just explained the tragedy to the others, broke down again. "Philippe, go and wake Burns," said Marcellus. "I fear we shall need his services." A few minutes later, I made my appearance, followed shortly by Denizen and his lady love. I had a dreadful hangover, but the terrible news acted like a cold shower. Although the circumstances of the tragedy seemed evident enough, the lovely Frida had met her fate in the form of a wild beast she had provoked. It was too much like something out of mythology for my taste. Marcellus, who I suspected of sharing my opinion, announced clumsily that I had a gift for precipitating such situations. I retorted that nothing would have happened if he hadn't invited me in the first place. Whilst Roger went to alert the police, I suggested my companions stay where they were until their arrival. I shall spare you the details of the police investigation and simply give you the conclusions of Commissaire Martin, who knew me by reputation, which made things a lot easier. Let's begin with the snow, which played a major role in the proceedings, in the sense of limiting the range of possibilities. Over a distance of 100 meters in all directions around the cabin, there was nothing but virgin snow except for the prints I already described. First, those of Frida leaving the lodge. They were still visible but faint, due to the fact that the snow had continued for about 20 minutes after she left at 10:30, after which not a single flake had fallen. Then, the tracks of the beast, coming out of the forest and doing a return trip from the spot where Frida's body was found. Due to the thickness of the undergrowth and the density of the trees, they couldn't be traced farther into the woods. They were indisputably the prints of a large canine, with no possibility of trickery. No trickery with the other prints either, those of our two witnesses, perfectly clear from the hedge of the lodge to the cabin, then to the shed, then back to the hedge again. There were no hiding places in the cabin, other than the two or three that had been carefully searched by the witnesses. I might add, though who could doubt it, that the police did not find a living soul at the scene of the crime. Next, there's the time of death, difficult to determine precisely because of the ambient cold, but at least 2 or 3 hours before the discovery of the body. 3 o'clock in the morning seems the best guess. Frida died from a hemorrhage, following the grievous wound to her hand. The experts identified the fang marks of a wolf or a large dog. The skin was curiously torn, but that was put down to the frenetic behavior of the beast. There was a bump on the left side of her skull, probably caused by her fainting, which would at least have alleviated the pain of her last moments. The police concluded from all the foregoing that the lovely Frida was the victim of a savage attack by a wild beast, which was eventually identified. A huge, half-wild Alsatian roamed the area, and nobody could approach it except a game warden who occasionally fed it. Apart from a few missing chickens, nobody had cause to blame it for anything until then. But its prowling silhouette and furtive behavior frightened all those who saw it, and who named it after the Nordic monster. It was never caught, but the tracks it left in the forest corresponded exactly to those near the victim. It was therefore the culprit, not just because the evidence pointed to it, but also because there could be no other explanation given that the condition of the snow ruled out any human intervention. That was the conclusion of the investigation. So where is the mystery, I hear you ask? After a moment's thought, I replied sardonically, "It's you who've blown the whole thing out of proportion, Owen." "Is that the only thought which crosses your mind about this extraordinary affair, Achilles? I suppose it's all that can be expected of a South African farmer or Homeric brute." Ignoring the double allusion to my origins and my name, I replied from the depths of my armchair, "No, of course not. There's obviously something fishy going on, probably some clandestine love affair. But since you've ruled out murder..." Now I shall tell you the rest, my friend, starting with the interviews of the suspects. The most enlightening was that of Philippe Udeville, when Commissaire Martin and I questioned him about his strange behavior upon the discovery of the body. Taking a look in the shed to see if the beast had gone to ground there was reasonable, but under the bed or in the clock, it didn't take him long to spill the beans. To be frank, I wasn't really surprised, because I had already suspected what he told us. It's a story as old as mankind, the eternal triangle of the wife, the lover, and the cuckold of a husband. Except in this case, it was Frida, our goddess of love, who had several lovers whom she met sporadically in the cabin on the occasion of Marcellus's parties, which were organized primarily for that purpose. All the male members of the group, without exception, had received Frida's favors, and she played with them all each time before making her choice. In other words, the nocturnal meeting with the wolf, even though Freya had genuinely tamed it, were a pretext for meeting a male, but a male of the biped kind. And, just as always in such situations, everyone was in the know, except the husband. Getting back to Udeville, he was unaware of the identity of the lucky candidate for that evening. He thought it might be me, given that I was the new arrival, but he was, alas, mistaken. In your role as noble knight, you would have saved her life by your mere presence, while, at the same time, preserving her virtue. Owen ignored the sarcasm. So, he thought the frightened lover might be hiding somewhere, but there clearly hadn't been a lover in the cabin that night, and Philippe Oudeville had been in bed with his wife, Helene. We had to tread carefully when we questioned her, because her husband beseeched us not to reveal the truth. Just like young Barbara and the jockey, she was unaware of the nighttime escapades of Frida, who was a childhood friend. Apart from hearing the distant howls at 6 in the morning, she was unable to tell us anything other than the concern she had felt for Frida following the discussions of the previous evening. From the window of her room, she had watched her husband and Louis Prans walk toward the cabin and had anxiously awaited their return. From their manner, it had been obvious something dreadful had happened. As a bachelor, Marcellus Blanchard wasn't in a position to furnish an alibi for the fatal time. He vaguely remembered hearing a distant scream, but he was half asleep and in the grip of a nightmare. He, too, suspected Frida had chosen me as her companion for the night, despite my tardy libations. Awakened by the departure of the jockey and the accountant, he had awaited their return behind the window of his room after having exchanged a few words with Roger in the corridor. Like Helene, he had feared the worst, just by observing the way they walked. Oudeville's tread was weary and resigned, and Prans's was bizarrely nervous. Needless to say, Marcellus was really down in the dumps. According to him, Frida had been more than a mistress. She was a much-loved friend, and Louis Prans hadn't deserved her. It's customary to feel sorry for the cuckolded husband, and, in this case, a widower as well, but Louis Prans was not one to inspire sympathy. Perhaps it was because he looked like an ill-tempered gnome. His affliction could not conceal his ham acting, or the unpleasant arrogance of the Erevist. I gathered from the interview that Frida hadn't married him for his blue eyes, and I took it upon myself not to open them regarding the wholly justifiable infidelities of his wife. Like Marcellus, he had no alibi other than solitary sleep in his bed. Roger, the steward, was discreet, efficient, and a keen observer to boot, for he noticed an apparently trivial anomaly which immediately attracted my attention. On the morning of the previous day, just before it began to snow heavily, he had cleaned the cabin, hoping, no doubt, to profit personally from the preparations. Amongst other things, he had wound the clock, which, he knew from personal experience, was as accurate as a Swiss watch. When he returned with the police the following morning, however, although it was still running smoothly, it showed a 10-minute delay. "Due to the cold, perhaps?" I suggested. "Perhaps, but it continued to function correctly afterwards, as I was able to verify." "I think I can see where you're headed," I observed, snapping my fingers. "The weight from the pendulum could have been used to knock the victim out." "Bravo, Achilles! I had exactly the same idea." "So, someone could have knocked Frida out and then, with a suitable instrument, faked the beast's attack. The problem is the creature's tracks, which prove it really was there." "Alas, yes. But still, the detail of the clock put me even more firmly amongst the skeptics, as if that were necessary. Getting back to Roger, he hadn't any better an alibi than the other bachelors. He hadn't heard the howls, but he'd been awakened by the departure of Oudeville and Prans. He'd run into his employer in the corridor, who had asked him about the rumpus, but he'd been unable to respond. After that, he'd gone to the kitchen to prepare coffee. Ian Denison, our noble Viking, had slept like a log until someone knocked on his door to tell him what had happened. He was undoubtedly the most disappointing witness. We didn't learn anything from him. I kept the lovely Barbara Riviere for last. She had spent the night with Denison, but had been unconscious due to the several sleeping pills she had taken following Frida's affront about the Turner watercolor, which had very much upset her. That little one is truly an artist, who sees things with greater perspicacity than a purely rational spirit like yours, Achilles. She saw right through Frida immediately, based on nothing more than the color of her dress, a yellowy green, like Eve's apple, which has been the color of sin since time immemorial, as I'm sure you know. Yes, of course. You could also call it feminine intuition. But frankly, Owen, I can't see where you're going. There can't be any criminal action lurking behind this tragedy. The immaculate whiteness of the snow has banished any evil human designs, if I may put it that way. Your account is the proof of that. Owen favored me with an unctuous smile full of irony. There's a lot of insight in your remark, Achilles, which is all to your credit, but let us shed the light of our intelligence on the matter, which was, in fact, a carefully prepared crime. What? Yes, a murder of the first water committed by the second jockey. Which second jockey? You've only mentioned one, the cuckolded husband. Allow me to explain. The crime itself went unpunished, for I didn't understand the mechanism until much later, after having heard the confession of one of the protagonists, who, without admitting his sin, clarified the motive. It was at the burial ceremony for his wife, Aline Udeville, who had just been carried away by a sudden heart attack. Beside himself with grief, Philippe Udeville, as if to absolve the deceased, shed further light on the dark side of Frida Prunes. We knew already that she was a femme fatale, but, according to him, she was worse than that. She gave free rein to her uncontrollable impulses and laughed at the wreckage she caused, seeming even to be stimulated by the misery of her victims. Helene was one of them. She suffered from an irrepressible jealousy, which only the elimination of the sinner who had led her husband, her childhood sweetheart no less, astray could cure. She insisted furthermore that Udeville himself help her in her sinister project. The future of their family and the well-being of their children, whom she cherished above everything, depended on it. Trapped in a typically masculine dilemma, Udeville found himself hating Frida while at the same time being unable to resist her charms. In order not to succumb further to temptation and to deliver himself once and for all from evil, he finally consented to help sacrifice the witch on the altar of their conjugal happiness. Needless to say, Udeville didn't tell me that in so many words, but I was able to piece it together from his hints, after which the solution was a piece of cake, particularly in view of the late running clock. The clock in Owen's lounge continued its regular tick-tock, which seemed particularly loud during the silence which followed. Having an accomplice certainly facilitates matters, I declared, but I can't see how that explains the extraordinary business entirely. And what does the clock have to do with it beyond what I proposed? Think carefully, Achilles. If it was 10 minutes late, that means it wasn't functioning during that time. In other words, it was blocked. I'm not ruling out the use of one of the weights as a weapon. But because Udeville peered inside to see if anyone was there, that meant that there could very well have been. A man hidden inside the base of a clock? Nonsense. Obviously not someone like you or me, but a diminutive woman with a supple waist, such as Udeville's wife. And Prunes didn't see anything? The door to the lower part wasn't glass-fronted, it was made of wood. And remember Udeville's behavior. He let it be understood quite casually that there was no one inside and immediately sent his companion to search under the bed, a clever way to deflect his attention. I suppose so, but how did Aline get into the cabin without leaving footprints in the snow? As easy as falling off a log, as you shall see. I was just telling you what put me on the right track. And once you start in the right direction, Achilles, the rest follows, as you well know. Initially, their plan was, I think, to frame Prunes, who would have made a perfect culprit as the cheated husband punishing his unfaithful wife. Frida's exploits would rapidly have come to light in any police investigation, so Udeville himself steered them in that direction. The jockey's loathsome personality and other factors made him the ideal scapegoat, provided the weather cooperated, which it did. Early in the fateful evening, Udeville lets Frida know discreetly that he will be joining her in the cabin later. Frida performs her Taming of the Wolf act and leaves at 10:30. It's still snowing lately. Helene takes her leave almost immediately, but instead of going upstairs to bed, she follows in Frida's footsteps, by which I mean she plants her feet precisely in the footprints left by her friend. The thin coat of snow which follows thereafter conceals the subterfuge. Ingenious. I hadn't thought of that. Child's play. Helene then joins her friend in the cabin and concocts a story to justify her presence and her desire to spend the night there. Since they'd known each other from childhood, it wouldn't have been difficult. I think her intention was to kill Frida brutally just before dawn, so that the first person into the cabin, which would be Prunes, because Udeville had intentionally followed at a distance, would be accused of the murder. After all, there would be virgin snow all around, and nobody apparently in the cabin, since Aline would be hiding inside the clock. That, as I say, was their plan, and a very ingenious one. Then, fate throws a spanner in the works, in the form of the wolf of Fenrir, who suddenly attacks his beloved friend. Yes, Achilles, and all because of me. Frida must have been thinking of my comment about Tyr's hand when she opened the door at 3 o'clock in the morning to the dog scratching at the door. Trying, no doubt, to impress her friend, show her how fearless she was, and prove the beast would never bite her, divine creature that she is, she must have upset it by offering it bacon from Roger's breakfast basket. But one cannot provoke a wild beast with impunity. The dog seizes her hand violently. She doubtlessly fights back, but the animal doesn't let go immediately. The result is an ugly wound. Then the beast runs off, and Frida needs to get back to the lodge urgently to have the wound treated, which will completely wreck the Udaville's diabolical plan. But Helene is a resourceful woman. The wolf of Fenrir will replace the jockey in the role of culprit. Everything happens very quickly. She knocks her friend out with a blunt instrument, probably a log from the fire, and proceeds to aggravate the wound with a knife to ensure she will bleed to death. Then, she waits until 6 o'clock to imitate the howl of a wolf, which is doubtless the prearranged signal to her accomplice. Udaville puts on a show to pretend his wife is still in her room, then sets off for the cabin with Prams. Helene hides in the clock and prays to the infernal gods that her husband, who will obviously be unaware of the new developments, will adapt to the situation. Everything goes smoothly. Checking that Helene is indeed inside the clock, he proceeds as planned. You can guess what happens next, Achilles, I feel sure. No, but I have no doubt you're going to tell me, I replied brusquely, irritated by more guessing games. More child's play. Haven't you ever played horsey by carrying a friend on your back? Udaville is deliberately wearing a voluminous cloak. While Prans is on all fours with his back turned, Helene hops out of the clock, thus liberating the pendulum, and onto her husband's back, hidden under the black cloak. None of that can be seen from the windows of the lodge because it's still night. And, needless to say, she restrains her mount on the way back, because their whole plan depends on their adversary, the real jockey, the great Louis Prans, the ex-champion of Longchamp, reaching the lodge ahead of them. He has to be first past the post in order that they successfully negotiate the last obstacle, the yew hedge. Helene drops to the ground just as they reach the dome-shaped entrance to the tunnel to avoid being seen when her husband enters the lodge. I'll spare you the rest of the details. For example, Philippe leaving the lounge on the pretext of fetching his wife from her room, which you can easily fill in yourself. I'll just say that Prans was not only a sot and a cuckold, but an unworthy representative of the stronger sex, for letting himself be beaten by a female jockey.
The Wolf of Fenrir is copyrighted by Paul Halter. The translation is copyrighted by John Pugmire. Music for this podcast is by Johann Sebastian Bach and was performed by Arthur Lesser. It was obtained from the Community Audio section of the Internet Archive. Mixing was done by Jackie Sherbo. You can subscribe to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine, where you'll find more stories like this one, by visiting our website at ellerycueenmysterymagazine.com.